we're talking about hopefulness and what Nigerians can tell us. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Young people in developing nations have a more positive outlook, and that's the upshot of an Ipsos poll last year. It found 9 out of 10 teenagers in a handful of developing countries were feeling positive about their future. And in Nigeria, young people's optimism is linked to their drive for social change. American optimism, on the other hand, it's been steadily declining. Why is that? What have you observed about how quality of life impacts your ability to have hope for the future and your ability to feel optimistic? We're at 800-642-1234. Chigozie Obioma is a professor of English and creative writing at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He is author of the award-winning novel, The Fisherman, and he wrote the Guardian piece called Life-Saving Optimism, What the West Can Learn from Africa. Chigozie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
You write that your home country, Nigeria, is largely seen by the rest of the world as this receptacle for ideas rather than a generator of ideas. But there's a mindset there that Westerners could potentially benefit and learn from. Can you explain how Nigerians think about their future and why it makes them more hopeful?
So I've just always gone back home very frequently to Nigeria, and it just strikes me as odd that nobody always talks. I almost never hear anyone saying, you know, I'm so tired of living, I'm going to like give up hope and all that. You know, rather what people always say is even the most, the poorest of the poor, the wretched of the earth, as they say, would always tell you, well, you know, something is going to turn around for me. I'm going to improve someday. And I just came back always, and I would think to myself, well, I mean, where is this coming from? Why is it that everybody is optimistic somehow? Who is going to help this guy who earns just $50 a month? How is the situation going to turn around? But he tenaciously believes that it will someday.
So last year, you spent several weeks in Nigeria interviewing dozens of people just on the street who you found, suffering from poverty and disability, other difficult circumstances. And when you decided to do this, what were you hoping to find out as you just sprouted these conversations with people you didn't know, complete strangers?
So my focus mostly was on suicide. I mean, look, I know that there is a lot of factors that can cause it here. In America, recently, it's being linked to the opioid crisis, you know, drugs and all that. But I wanted to find if, struggles and poverty and serious privation can actually lead to that. So, you know, I would start these conversations in the cars, in the marketplace with just taxi drivers, and just ask them, you know, okay, so look at how your family, your situation is. Have you ever thought of, taking your own life? And the answer consistently was no. One guy walked me out of his car out of anger. He was like, are you Nigerian? How can you even think of such a thing? So there is a premium place to life that life has to continuously be lived, no matter the situation. And I found that very striking and reassuring.
You talked to a young man who worked a 24-hour shift as a security officer at a hotel. You talked with a tailor who survived by carrying around a sewing machine from the 1800s stitching
from
clothes.
From the 1800s, yes.
I mean, you found people who had to be in the depths of very difficult circumstances, and yet they were hopeful. They were awake and aware of where they were going in life.
Yeah, so there is a belief. I think there are two reasons for this. Number one, traditionally in the pre-colonial African cultures across almost all the tribes that make up Nigeria, and most West African and East African countries as well, there was, a sense of, life being a continuity to life that, you know, is ingrained in the culture. And of course, suicide was also frowned at. And also, the communities were so connected that it was difficult to say that somebody was poor, because there was a sense of societal connection wherein if somebody is in need, the communities will gather around and help them. So now that we have become more urbanized and westernized and to some extent modernized, you find that people are losing some of those connections to some extent, but they are still very, very much linked, much more than here in the West. So that was one. But also there's a deep religiosity in Africa and spirituality that gives people a sense of hope. So there is this outside external force that will someday intervene. So far as I continue to do my own due diligence and ask for that help. So it's a very strong belief. And I feel like the more Western countries become much more secular, they might be losing that sense of, you know, dependency on these extraordinary force that has the ability to mitigate my situation when all else fails.
We're talking with Chigozie Obioma. He's an English professor, creative writing professor at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and author of The Fisherman. You can join in this conversation as we look at Nigeria and find out what Nigerians see in the world that provides their optimism and how that can translate here in the West. Have you been happier at times of your life when you had less, or did you truly feel optimistic once you reached a point of stability? Have you traveled and seen and learned from other cultures and ways of life? Did you adopt any traditions or ways of thinking that were new to you? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. You were, Chigozie, able to ask strangers in Nigeria questions that Americans might consider really invasive of our space. Do you think people, even if they're strangers, are more connected in African countries than we are here in America?
Yes. In fact, you know, here people rarely, it's changing, but my first impression of the U.S. was that nobody's talked about politics in public spaces. But in Nigeria is, you know, we're not that, right now, we're not that divided ideologically yet. I think that that might come in the future. So you can go into a bus or a plane and everybody will be talking about, you know, politics. This person will say, oh, you know, the price of gas is rising so highly that I find it very disgusting. And everybody would just join in, and people will say they have aired their views, you know, openly without any, they don't know who they're talking with. So you there's a sense that we are all in this together, and you know, you can access anybody, anybody's idea very freely, you know. So I mean, there are some questions, of course, that you can't ask people. You can't ask them, you know, without their permission, maybe about their sex life or something like that on the street. But you can pretty much ask people anything.
Talking with Chigozie Obioma, we're talking about hopefulness and what we can learn from Nigerians in a poverty-stricken nation. Hope abounds. How can that translate here in the U.S.? You can join in with your observations as you travel. 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the hopefulness we can learn from people who live in the developing world. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In Nigeria, everybody lives on a miracle. People believe that no matter what their circumstance, it's bound to turn around. Whether it is poverty, political unrest, no condition is permanent. What have you observed about how quality of life impacts your ability to have hope for the future and your ability to feel optimistic? Have you been happier at times of your life when you had less? Chigozie Obioma stays with us, thinks about this a lot. He is a University of Nebraska Lincoln English and Creative Writing professor. In a recent visit to his motherland, he interviewed dozens of Nigerians, strangers on the street, and he asked, "Are you happy?" And he found that they were, and he found that the idea of suicidal thoughts was rather absurd. And so as you traveled there and look at the family structures, and you say there are some conversations that are private and off limits, but generally speaking, people are readily able to share, even though this is a country where there's been a lot of political unrest, instability, Boko Haram. We see that in the headlines. Why do you feel people are able to air their views and how they see the world?
Well, there's a number of things. So I think part of what drives the openness is, of course, people are not happy with the way in which the country, the direction in which the country is moving. So there's I have to make a distinction here. I mean, people have hope, but it doesn't really mean that they are necessarily happy. So some of them are, you know, they feel like, oh, things could be better, and they are right. Recently, 3 weeks ago, I was in Nigeria, and I was speaking on the radio and, you know, promoting my new novel, An Orchestra of Minorities. And people were calling in, like, you know, this is your show. And some guy called in. He was so surprised to hear me, you know, my profile, you know, having written these books and being a professor and all that. And I was about his age, mate. But he was, you know, involved in breaking pipelines and trying to, like, kidnap oil workers because his city had been destroyed by oil spillage from all this mining and all these things. So he said, you know, how did you get to the point where you are? I felt like I had to do something. I had to go into violence because I was so unhappy with the state and condition of my hometown. And I told him, look, there's nothing to be ashamed about. We are both doing the same thing. We are angry. And that's why I write. It's just a mode of expression that is different. I express my anger through fiction while you engage in that kind of violence. So there are a lot of people who feel unhappy about the situation, but that even forces them more to hope that, look, if only I can make one or two more efforts, if only I can go forward in this direction, then my life will be good. So that sense that there's something in the future that will definitely turn around to you know, my favor is what drives the people. This a radical sense of optimism that is really hard to come by elsewhere.
Interesting that you express your anger, that innermost feelings through fiction, through writing, and you are trying to get your students to do the same thing, to confront their own past, their own childhood, their own hardship through writing. What have you learned about their past through their writing?
So I noticed that, you know, especially when teaching 17, 18-year-olds in Midwest America, most of them are too young to really, they've not had the, you know, the experience of life to be able to mine, you know, a lot of resources for, like, fiction. So they tend to look much more inwardly. How about the grandmother who died of cancer a few years ago? How about the farm accident that caused my dad to lose a hand or a foot or something like that? So they look within. So I get exposed to some of these things. A lot, in fact, has happened in their lives. Things that, of course, can cause them to be, you know, sad and all that. So I've learned a lot about, you know, the struggles of Americans. Even though on the surface it does seem like, you know, everything is flashy and there are all these glimpses of, like, sparkling wealth and affluence. But, you know, there's something deeply human about them as well. But also, so I try to get them to, like, write about these things in ways that are that will not just be like just recounting these various pockets of hardships, but rather to create an arc around these stories, and turn them into something with an arc, let me say, very
Right.
optimistic.
It, tragedy strikes every social class. It knows no boundaries, hardship.
Yes.
And there was a survey conducted last year that found 94% of Nigerian youth are optimistic about their futures, while only 65% of Swedish teenagers said the same thing. You were recently in Sweden. What did you find about the hopefulness of their youth?
So it is very interesting that on the day I got to Sweden, my publicist from my publisher, her brother just attempted suicide for the third time. And so it's something that is really rising there. For me, again, I would go back and say, look, part of it is because of the spiritual composition of most youths in Nigeria. The more, so it's just about how, so it's the society in which you find yourself. So in America, there's a, or in Sweden, in very developed countries, there's a lot that human beings can do. We have conquered the earth, so to say, that we have built all these structures and all these things. So once something doesn't click, once there's something that is not going, we're so used to order here, that any slight twist out of the regime, the everyday regime or routine, can be interpreted as chaos. But in Nigeria, these young people are so used to disorderliness, they can tolerate almost anything. In the street where my auntie lives, in Lagos, there hadn't been electricity for 4 days, consistently. There wasn't power at all, and nobody complained. People were like, it was so normal. So imagine that happening in, right now I'm in Des Moines or somewhere in Wisconsin. People will march into the street. People would think maybe, some kind of Armageddon has happened. So they're used to that kind of disruptive living, wherein Swedish young people are not.
We're talking with Chigozie Obioma about what we can learn from Nigerians about happiness and optimism. He's an English and creative writing professor at University of Nebraska-Lincoln. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find hope in spirituality or religion? What gives you that hope? Do you find hope internally, externally, or both? Call in. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Let's look for a moment at spirituality and religion, very intertwined with how Nigerians think about life in the future. Can you explain for us how religion is so connected to the Nigerian mindset of hopefulness?
For me, I think part of it is not very healthy because it can lead to some form of complacency in which people don't feel the need to actually do much, or have that much agency to be able to order society in the way it should go. So there's a bad side to it. But the strongest message in churches and in mosques in Nigeria is, look, God is going to turn your life around. So at the beginning of the year, they always do these campaigns across most churches, saying, oh, this is what my life will be. So it's like you prophesying to yourself into your own life. This is my year. 2019 will be my year of fulfillment, for instance. And people take these prayers and put them on their door, and they truly believe it. They believe that something new will happen for them in a particular year. And every new year, that is renewed. Even if they didn't achieve it in the past year, they'll say, well, this new year, something new will happen. Maybe it will be my year of opportunities or something. So there's an ongoing drive that is encouraged by the spiritual houses that keeps people moving, and so there's a lot to it, but this is one of the, I think, the strongest component of that.
Talking with English and creative writing professor Chigozie Obioma about finding hopefulness in Nigeria and what people in first world countries can take away from this life-saving optimism. What have you observed about how quality of life impacts your ability to have hope for the future and your ability to feel optimistic? Join in. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll look at whether young people in the U.S. can develop a healthier and more optimistic outlook on life. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. Exploring hopefulness and optimism among Nigerians and whether we can find a similar mindset here in the U.S., a rich nation by comparison. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. For years now, Nigeria has been ranked one of the most optimistic nations in the world, and American optimism in comparison is in decline, which seems strange since Nigeria has pervasive poverty and corruption and the extremist group Boko Haram, with which, you know, civilians caught in the crossfire, many dead and disappearing. You can join in with your observations at 800-642-1234. Have you been happier at times of your life when you had less? Or did you truly feel optimistic once you reached a point of stability and security? Maybe you've traveled and seen and learned from other cultures and ways of life. Did you adopt any traditions or practices or ways of thinking that were new to you that you use now in your life? You can join in by phone at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chigozie Obioma has been on a journey to find where this optimism comes from and how it might translate to his students at University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where he teaches English and creative writing. Chigozie, there are pros and cons to each of these ways of thinking about how you live your life. And we know that the pros to the Nigerian mindset are what we've been talking about: more optimism, more hopefulness, arguably better mental health. What are the cons? What's the downside to this Nigerian mindset?
Well, it leads to people tolerating a lot of things that they shouldn't. For instance, if you go to a place like Lagos, it's two different cities in one. There is a part that is so advanced, the Victoria Island, the islands that sit on the Atlantic Ocean. You know, it can be like comparable to any city in the developed world. But then you go to the mainland, and there is a lot of privation and suffering. And people just endure like a lot of things. So I feel like because of these high dependency on hope and on this feeling that something good will come out from some miraculous source in the future, and these high level dependency on spirituality, they don't see any need to do anything radical, revolutionary to change that. But I suspect that somebody who is more like attuned to a more secular and practical way of thinking would not tolerate some of that. So that's like the major con. But also there is a lot of, I think there's also something to be said for the way in which people sometimes cannot rationalize things very easily. So there are some things that we don't need to, recourse to spirituality and all that, or some kind of higher form of thinking, but people often do. So I think those are the cons that I can see. So, I mean, it can explain one of the reasons why Swedish people, are more technologically advanced than West Africans.
When I think of American mindset, the Western mindset, often I'm thinking that we're perhaps a bit more cynical. There's cynicism. There's tethered to our phones, looking at our phones and social media and not really aware of the world around us. In what ways is there a downside, do you see, in a very developed, rich nation to our outlook?
Well, of course, it can make Americans more insular. Americans can be sometimes lose perspective because, you know, if you think about it, in some ways, this feels like, you know, the headquarters of the world in a way. The Hollywood American culture is appreciated and consumed by everybody. You can go to a town or a village in Ethiopia and at least probably everybody there has seen an American movie. But, you know, you can come to a place in suburban Des Moines and they don't even know where Ethiopia is, you know. So there's a striking difference there. So I think insularity is a thing. And if you know, if you have more perspective that, you know, there are other people in the world with different ways of living, then maybe that can help with the optimism. You know, I tell them when they say, okay, I'm about to graduate and I'm thinking of being a writer full time, I want to be like you. I say, okay, very good. You know what you should do next? Do not apply to graduate school. Go into take a trip to China or go to Mexico or something. Go and work at a bar there and just see a different way of life. Be exposed to dialogues, listening to what people are saying in these places. Ride the bus from Adana to Mersin in Turkey and just listen in and see and watch people. And this is how you enlarge your horizon and your understanding of the human condition.
And that will translate into their writing. They'll be able to have those experiences to take with them into their own writing.
Absolutely, without question.
We're talking with Chigozie Obioma. He's an English and creative writing professor at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and looking at his observations about Nigerians, their outlook, and what he sees among his own students in Nebraska. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Chigozie, compared to much of the rest of the world, Americans comparatively have the stability, they have the security. How do you see that quality of life connected to our depression, our hopelessness, and the suicide that we see?
For me, it's a paradox, you know. And also, you know, America is actually a little different from other Western countries. Because Americans are still very religious, you know, mostly, or at least probably is now divided into half of Americans are, half are not. You still have the Bible Belt and the South that is very religious. So you know, it's not in that sense like France or Sweden. But somebody said to me, somebody made an observation after I wrote that essay in The Guardian. You know, he wrote me this long email and he made a very interesting observation. He said Americans, even the religious ones, tend to treat spirituality as a ritual, while in other parts of the world, like in West Africa, people treat it more as faith. So if it's a kind of ritual, a kind of body of events that people have to do at a particular time, maybe at Easter or something like that, or even if they attend churches regularly, but the order and stability that they have, that sense of human agency precedes everything, and every other thing is secondary. But in Nigeria, I think they are balanced out. You know, a person is acting, is doing something, but also believes that while doing that, there is some kind of spiritual backup for what they are doing, you know, in real time. So that is like a faith. So it's religion is treated differently than you have here in America. So religion and faith is somehow the bedrock of society, while in America is something that people can do on the side, just a separate part of their life that they can dispense with anytime if they want to.
Do you think African optimism is something that Americans, young and old, can learn?
Well, I think there's something to be said for that. So in every culture, you can look at what is working and what is not, and you can learn something from there. I don't think Americans should be averse from doing that. Nigerians also should be more practical minded, because there are just some things that, you know, you don't need to tolerate, that we can fix ourselves. There's a lot of corruption, even though we are very religious. So Americans haven't, you know, arranged their society in such a way that there's a lot of order, there's a lot of accountability. You know, the society actually functions. It's just that there is something in the human condition that still needs a filling up. So there seems to be, even though, you know, there's all these things that we have here, there's a need every now and then, a craving for something more profound. I feel like that's what might be missing in some of the young people, especially, you know, with the proliferation of social media and the loss of connectivity to deeper family connections these days. So Nigerians still have that, and I think Americans can learn that. But Nigerians also can learn, you know, more practical ways of organizing society.
Chigozie, as we close this conversation, you look out to a classroom of young writers starting their careers. How do you give these young people hope?
Well, I tell them, you know, just to connect more deeply with, you know, the aspect what they want to be in the future, and not to allow anything to, you know, weigh them down. I tell them about the graph of life. Somebody told me during the experiment I did in Nigeria, that what do I think during one of those conversations? How would I plot the graph of the typical life of an individual? Will it be a straight line? Will it be a concave? What would it look like? And he said that most often it is zigzag. So you rise and fall, you rise, you stand up again, you fall, you stand up again, and you keep on going. So I tell them, do not expect that your life will be a straight line. No, there will be glitches here and there.
Chigozie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Chigozie Obioma is an English professor at University of Nebraska, looking at hope here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about tracking antibiotic resistance across Wisconsin here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers at UW-Madison have a tool that will allow different hospitals to share their data on antibiotic-resistant bacteria. Have you gotten an infection during a hospital stay? Did your physician have trouble finding an antibiotic that would work for you? Do you worry about antibiotic resistance? We're at 800-642-1234. Laurel Lagenza is Interim Director of Global Health and an Assistant Scientist at UW-Madison School of Pharmacy, and she's been working with other researchers at the School of Pharmacy and at the State Cartographer's Office to develop this system to map antibiotic resistance across Wisconsin. Laurel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you.
Well, it looks just like a weather map, but this is tracking pathogens, not weather systems. Your tool will allow hospitals to share their data. How does this tool work?
Sure. So right now, our current maps are looking at what's called antibiogram data, which is data that hospitals and health systems collect that measure the percent of a bacteria like E. coli that respond to the antibiotic. So we have about 70 data points that represent over 200,000 isolates that are mapped together using geographic methods to create predictions of what's the percent chance that an infection would respond to an antibiotic. And what you see in the map is really distinct patterns, that there's variation in each antibiotic across the state.
So how could this sharing this information between hospitals improve how physicians treat their patients?
Sure. So when a patient comes and needs to be treated before their laboratory results are final, the patient often wants to go home. This information would help guide a physician's decision to pick an antibiotic that's most likely to treat the infection or that the infection would not be resistant to the antibiotic.
Why is it so tricky choosing a particular antibiotic? Why might you have a better chance with one versus another?
So we know that there's distinct patterns of antibiotic resistance geographically and even within a hospital. So we have lots of different tools and resources to make that treatment decision, including guidelines and patient characteristics. But another factor that should be considered is the local pattern of resistance that might impact whether or not that bacteria responds to the antibiotic.
So will this tool track just antibiotic-resistant bacteria, or will it track other dangerous microbes, perhaps like antifungal-resistant things?
That's certainly a threat to global health right now, is the antifungal infections as well, or antifungal resistance. And right now we're focusing on bacteria, but certainly in the future we're interested in including the fungal infections.
So do hospitals just readily give you this data? Where do you acquire the data in order to map what you're mapping?
Sure. So we're partnering right now with a microbiologist and laboratory networks for the antibiogram data. But the next phase of the project is looking at more specific level data. So we'll be partnering with the hospitals directly in an agreement that ensures the data is secure and protected. And then it will be, it won't have any identifying information, but will be used to geographically map the patterns we see.
So once the tool is ready, do you plan on tracking its impact on how hospitals use antibiotics? And if that impacts the maps that you've got going, the antibiotic resistant maps?
So we know that antibiotic resistance can be associated with antibiotic use, and it's one of the main risk factors. So we're interested in the next phases of the project to look at antibiotic use by the health system and also look at larger measures of magnitude, such as antibiotic distribution and antibiotic sales, and even looking at proximity to agriculture and any antibiotics that might be used in that setting, to help inform what the risk is of resistance in each area.
We're talking with Laurel Lagenza. She's Interim Director of Global Health and an Assistant Scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Pharmacy, looking at a new tool that helps track pathogens and how hospitals use antibiotic-resistant bacteria and what they know works and doesn't work through a new tracking system. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. So as you develop this tool beyond Wisconsin, what do you think hospitals and the medical community globally should do to tackle this problem of antibiotic resistance?
So globally, it's only one part of potential solutions is considering the local antibiotic resistant trend. I think also economically, there can be more incentives to develop new antibiotics because as our available antibiotics are being reduced, there's difficulty in getting a new antibiotic to market when there may not be the financial incentive with our current market. Because antibiotics are not used over a long amount of time, they actually should be limited as well in their use to prevent future resistance.
And when you did the mapping, you found some pockets of antibiotic resistance in more densely populated areas. You found some even in valleys. What can we learn about the topography and population impacting resistance?
Sure. So we don't know yet for sure what the causes are of these decreased areas of antibiotic susceptibility, but we'll be exploring that more as the project continues. And we think that it might be related to that population density, agriculture, as well as the direction of watersheds, because we know antibiotics can also get into the environment.
How could agriculture impact antibiotic resistance?
So sometimes antibiotics are used in farming, both to treat infections.
Laurel, are you still there? I think we have just lost her. That is Laurel Lagenza. She is Interim Director of Global Health and an Assistant Scientist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Pharmacy. And she, and along with other researchers at the School of Pharmacy and the State Cartographer's Office, they've been developing a system that maps antibiotic resistance across Wisconsin. And coming up, we're going to be talking about, we're going to be looking at politics on the local level and the global level, also looking at weather and flooding along the Wisconsin River. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.